David Siegel here, your favorite podcast host. Before we get into today's episode, I have something important to share. Check out my new book, Decide and Conquer, to really get to know my story at Meetup. You know, the hardest thing about community leadership is making tough decisions when the stakes are high. And I'll tell you, they were never higher than when Meetup was owned and sold by WeWork. In my new book, Decide and Conquer, I'll walk you through a counterintuitive framework for decision-making and the epic journey of Meetup's surprising survival. Good leaders deliberate, great leaders decide. Now decide and conquer by pre-ordering my book today by going to decideandconquerbook.com or anywhere books are sold. Thank you.
Welcome.
ようこそ.
Bienvenue.
आपका स्वागत है.
Bienvenido.
환영합니다.
Welcome.
Welcome to Keep Connected. I'm David Siegel. Today we have a special guest. It's me, host becomes guest, and Radha, take it away.
Hello, listeners. My name is Radha Agarwal, founder and CEO of Daybreaker, the global dance community and movement, and author of Belong. I am taking over David Siegel's spot today as the show host, interviewing him on his new book and what it means to be a leader at Meetup and all of his incredible trials and tribulations to get to the leader that he is today. So let's get into it. Wow, what an honor. Great to be here and welcome to Keep Connected. So David, great to have you on your own podcast.
Excited to be here. I haven't been a guest in ever.
So, you know, just kick us off, like, why are we swapping today?
I loved having you as a guest. It was, you know, you have a lot of, I have three children. No one could ever say who your favorite child is. So with 30 podcast episodes or so far, I can't say who my favorite podcast guest was, but you were definitely one of the top podcast guests. And I had just such an amazing time talking to you that when someone said, hey, sometimes it's fun to just do a little bit of a flip and have a guest host and you as the host become a guest so that people can get to know you a little bit longer, a little bit more, then I thought Radha is the perfect host for this. So that's what we're doing. Get to know me a little more, get to know you a little more, talk about some community stuff and talk about Meetup and go from there.
So maybe just kick us off since both of us are so deeply steeped in the world of community. Why is community and connection so important to you?
So I grew up and I still am an observant kind of Orthodox Jew. And because of that, we went to synagogue all the time. We have guests over 10, 15, 20 guests over on Friday nights, over on Saturdays. We hang out in a collective community with 200-300 people every single Saturday. And it just became a very big part of my life. And there also has been times during life transitions that I've had less community, whether it's starting college or moving after college. And I saw such a contrast between the life that I grew up with and at times not having that community that you tend to appreciate things more. And that's when, you know, the opportunity to become CEO of Meetup, I was like, oh my God, yes, whatever it is, yes, I want to do it.
Well, as a half Indian, half Japanese woman, you know, I'm very, very, very familiar with the concept of gathering, you know, sort of with your community members and how imprinting that is early on. So really, really cool. That was such an ending part of your early childhood as well. How do you go from sort of, I love community to I want to be the CEO of Meetup? You know, how does one make that leap?
I had always wanted to become a CEO from a pretty early age. I had first worked in business, actually in human resources. I was a human resources manager, which is not a common path to go from an HR manager to CEO. However, HR managers tend to focus on things like recruiting top people. How do you motivate people? How do you manage people effectively? How do you create amazing work environments? How do you create a great culture? All those things that HR managers kind of focus on. Then I realized when I was an HR manager at a company called DoubleClick 20 plus years ago, I would advise on all these things that were really important to organizations getting the most out of people. But ultimately, the decision maker was the general manager or the CEO. So I said, hey, I really believe in trying to help people to become their best selves at work and their best selves in general. HR could do a liaisoning role in that. But if you are overseeing a company, then you really can help to build a culture. You can really help to build processes that make people love what they do and happier in their lives. And it was at that moment that I decided I needed to go to business school because I just didn't understand enough. Went to business school, and then there was a kind of a series of roles, and I had a series of mentors who were also CEOs of companies. And then I, you know, did the typical, went to manager, to director, to a president of a company at a pretty early age. Then I became a CEO at 40 years old of Investopedia. That was my first CEO job. Investopedia then got sold, and Adam Neumann and WeWork came a knocking on the door and said, "Hey, David, would you like to become the potential CEO, the first outside CEO of Meetup?" And 27 interviews over a 4-month period later, I became the CEO 3.5 years ago. So easy peasy. Anyone can do it.
Wow. And what a circuitous and also just thoughtful journey that you've taken to become CEO of Meetup. So, you know, what attracted you to Meetup in the first place? Like, what aspects do you like about Meetup that attracted you to the role?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I had always been going to Meetup events. I had not been a Meetup organizer, though I am a Meetup organizer now, and I love it. In fact, I have another event tomorrow for my group.
Nice.
Yeah, can't wait for it, actually. We have about 200 people in the group. The thing that attracted me most really was Meetup's role when it comes to the loneliness epidemic that kind of exists in this world. You hear the studies, 46% of people regularly feel lonely. Millennials, Gen Zers, it's like 62% of people feel lonely. I have 70 students in my class, and I talk to them at times when they're comfortable sharing about challenges that they have and the negative results of loneliness and depression that could come from it and all the other challenges. And Meetup is the cure for the loneliness epidemic. I mean, to be able to work for a company that has 57 million members where we're helping people to become less lonely, OMG. I mean, seriously, as my kids would say, like, I got the best job in the world and I'm crazy lucky to have it.
As a community architect myself, when I think of 56 million people whose lives you're serving and supporting, I just, my whole heart bursts wide open. You know, as you were sharing about the whole WeWork experience, you know, and you shared about this so thoughtfully and actually beautifully written in your book, you know, I'm not one for salacious storytelling, but can you explain the difference between sort of your staff management and WeWork and sort of what, you know, why did Meetup succeed while WeWork stumbled? Like, I'm really curious to hear your take on that. And you share that very deeply in your book. And I really, really love that. But I think just for the listeners to get a little taste, it'd be great to hear.
Now, WeWork was incredibly focused on growth for growth's sake. The goal was growth. And the challenge with growth for growth's sake, as opposed to growth for mission's sake, meaning that if a mission of a company, let's say, is to cure the loneliness epidemic, and growing conflicts with that, it doesn't for Meetup, but if we grew too fast, that would be a problem. So if the entire mission of a company is essentially growth, 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 and you're not able to support that growth in any way, then what happens is you create negative and challenging experiences for people as part of that growth. So that for in WeWork's case, the challenges were internal. They went from, you know, 1,000 employees to 10,000 employees, you know, practically overnight. And what that meant is people had, you know, people would have like 5 managers, 6 managers in the course of a year. There were 6 different people doing the exact same position and they didn't even know it or talk to each other. There was just so much chaos that rang through the organization that it added tremendous amounts of stress because there were these growth goals because the business valuation was $47 billion that they had to hit that just made success nearly impossible. A lot of that does stem from the leader, from Adam Neumann, who genuinely wanted and still wants to make the world a better place. He really does care. And a lot of people don't appreciate that. They hear the stories about money or other things. He really does want to make the world a better place. He just wasn't equipped to be able to effectively do so because he didn't understand that processes and infrastructure are actually the great enablers to growth. And the concept, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this, of like sometimes fast is slow and slow is fast is an important thing to understand. And it goes, Radha, you know, in terms of personal growth that we all go through, if you try to like do too many leaps too fast, you could end up crashing back down very, very quickly. If you try to make some kind of leap in your life, a habit that you want to take on, and then you work on that, then it becomes sustainable. Then you work on the next thing, it becomes sustainable. So in WeWork's case, there was just so much growth that the crash was almost inevitable, and the crash ended up obviously coming down. At WeWork, excuse me, at Meetup, we try to grow in a slow, steady place that we're able to ultimately help our organizers, help our members along the path versus, you know, potentially to blow things up later. And it's, you know, something that I feel pretty good about, which is, you know, before Meetup, WeWork, excuse me, before WeWork, Meetup was losing close to $20 million a year. And then the pandemic happened. WeWork sold Meetup, and we've been more profitable the last few years than really any time in our history. Not a lot, but enough that we're sustainable, will last forever, and any additional profit we try to plow back into creating better experiences. So to me, the goal is not just one-time successes or unsustainable activity, but it's everything is about, to me, creating sustainability through creating the right processes and infrastructure.
Wow, what a tale. I can't wait to get into the full thing. But you talk about sort of slow and steady growth, and you know, leadership, you know, both of us as CEOs of our own, you know, kind of movements and communities, and you talk about growth for growth's sake versus growth for mission's sake. As a leader, you know, as a CEO, how do you know what the fine line is between growth and mission? Because our fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders is to actually grow the business. So when you say slow and steady growth, what does that look like? How do you plan for that as a leader? And for those listening, right, who are also in leadership roles, what is your advice for them? Because hockey stick growth clearly does not work. But how do you actually manage thoughtful growth where your investors are happy and your community members are happy as well?
Great. So the first thing, what an amazing question. You should become a podcast host. the first thing to, I think, to recognize is that they're not mutually exclusive, which you have said. And one of the things I oftentimes talk about is that revenue and profit give oxygen to our mission, meaning the more that you're able to have a successful business, the more that you're able to ultimately achieve a company's mission. And then back to your question, which is, how do you know if you're growing too fast? Can you understand? So I would say there's two answers to that. First is, people oftentimes ask the question, how do you know if you have product market fit, right? How do you know if when an entrepreneur is starting a business, whether that product is actually of real interest to the market or not? And there's quantitative answers and more qualitative answers. I tend to look at the more qualitative, but quantitatively, you could look at NPS, which is Net Promoter Score, which has been shown by numerous studies as one of the best questions to ask about how good a product or service is, which is essentially the question of, would you recommend this to a friend? And if you start seeing your NPS and Net Promoter Scores going down as you grow, then that's telling you something. It's telling you the quality of the product, the quality of the experience is not the same as it used to be. And you need to dig into that and understand it. That's a quantitative metric. Qualitatively, however, to me is more important. Qualitatively, what kind of feedback are you getting? And kind of, you know it when you see it. There's a famous statement by a Supreme Court justice around in the 1970s, I think it was Breyer, but I'm not exactly sure, of what's the definition of pornography? And the answer was by a Supreme Court justice, you know it when you see it. So my point to that is that when a CEO or a leader kind of starts seeing their customers getting more frustrated, starts seeing that the infrastructure and the processes that had worked in the past are not working today, they know it. They know it. And the key is to say, let's step back here and let's figure out what we're doing wrong before we start growing even faster, and then just keep making the same exact mistakes over and over again, but for a much larger audience.
Wow, that's so good. And I feel like it's so evolved, you know, sort of compared to so many of kind of the shareholder-led and shareholder-run public companies that exist out there. So it's just so comforting to hear that you both think of things qualitatively and quantitatively.
Yeah, I mean, a recent another example besides me, besides WeWork, is what's going on with Peloton. I mean, Peloton just announced 3,000 job cuts. It's an amazing product. John Foley is someone I actually know personally. He's an incredible individual. He decided to step down more recently. But what he said is he said, the pandemic is not a strategy. The pandemic that we're all under is a situation that prevents opportunities and challenges, but ultimately it's not a sustainable strategy. And when you're a leader, you kind of know that the situation you're in, either good or bad, is usually not going to continue forever. And for Meetup, we knew that we're going to get back together in person, and we're 68% in person today, and it's going to, and it keeps growing really every single month. Daybreaker had times where it wasn't in person, times where it is in person, and now you're going on this amazing tour and hitting 8 or 9 different cities as part of the Daybreaker movement with your 500,000 people. And you knew that it's going to come back, and it's going to come back amazingly. And people are so desperate for Meetup, and they're so desperate for Daybreaker. But ultimately, the situation that whether Peloton was in, which was for the good, or other organizations like ours have been in that have been posed challenges, it's not what the future is. And understanding that is really important.
Wow. Yes. You know, in your amazing book, Decide and Conquer, which is coming out very soon here, you talk about a decision framework that you came up with, which I really, really connect with. There's so many concepts in here that are, you know, sort of both tried and true, but also feel new. How do you decide when to be confident about your leadership decisions, or when do you know when to sort of be more long-term focused? You know, sort of you talk about be kind, be confident, be long-term focused, be honest. When do you apply different decisions to your everyday leadership?
I think in overall, and thank you for listing a whole bunch of them, and thank you for pre-reading the book also, because I know you gave us some great help and feedback on it, so really appreciate it. I think the number one component to effective decision making, before we get into, if we have time, you know, the different kind of values that I focus on in the framework, is surrounding yourself by people who will disagree with you. One of the biggest risks that leaders can do in making a decision is to have too many yes people around them. The key is finding people who think differently than you, and creating an environment where disagreement is championed, because the more disagreement that you have, the better and smarter decision you're going to make. So for example, one of the things that we do at Meetup is before meetings, before an offsite, for example, we will have someone put their point of view on a document. Everyone needs to read that document, add areas where they agree and disagree with that point of view. And then the entire conversation is about where do we agree, where do we disagree? And let's not talk about where we agree. That's a waste of time. Let's talk about all the areas where we disagree. And I tell people, don't show up to this meeting if you didn't add anything to the document where you didn't disagree about something, because then the whole goal is to have some disagreement there. What I also like about that is it allows people who are more introverted, who sometimes don't feel as comfortable talking up in a meeting, but may have the smartest things to say, and oftentimes introverts, by the way, truly do. Mm-hmm. Those individuals can be on equal footing and can be more thoughtful in their responses and if something is actually documented. So I guess my first answer to kind of a decision process is, make sure that there's disagreement. In fact, oftentimes what we will do at Meetup is someone will say something and I'll say, I think I agree with you, but I'm going to disagree just because disagreement is so important. And we champion, we don't want to make any critical decisions unless there's enough debate that happens first. That's kind of an overriding factor in anything that one could do around decision-making.
I love that. You know, I think one the thing that came up for me when you were saying that, first of all, is so courageous to be asking for your team members to disagree with you. You know, in a world that is so polarized and we live in a takedown world, if you choose to go a direction that is against someone's feedback, you know, you also risk them taking you down or speaking negatively about you to press or media or whatever it may be. So, you know, you have to really strike the right balance between, you know, building the container for this type of disagreement to happen in a way that feels safe for everyone. And I think that that's your leadership in action. And I think that's so hard to do.
Thank you. I mean, if someone acts defensively, for example, when they're having someone disagree with them, that's just the death knell. Because then you don't facilitate a culture of disagreement. You don't help people to understand that the best thing they could do is to disagree. And by the way, I'm a big believer, and I talk about this in Decide and Conquer quite a bit, in listening and selectively following. So you want to listen to all people's point of view. But just mm-hmm. because you're listening to someone's point of view doesn't mean you have to follow their point of view. You want to listen to everyone and get everyone's feedback, but also you can't feel the burden that just because you got feedback from someone, if a person's a board member, if a person's even a manager, a person's really, really important, doesn't mean you need to follow what they say. You have to use your gut to figure out what the right decision is, but ultimately listen to all, but selectively follow.
I mean, you know, I think we live again in a world where we are often listening to two persons' complaint in a 1,000-person office environment. So it is comforting to hear that the concept of selective following continues to exist in leadership, because we do live in somewhat of a, you know, sort of society that just listens to the few voices at the negative side of the spectrum rather than the collective voice of the group in general. So I really appreciate this part of it. So how would you describe yourself as a leader? How would you describe, like, what is David Siegel like as a leader? And what would your team member say about you?
Whoa. Okay. So I would say that I am, as a leader, the same exact way as I am as a person and as a friend. Yes. There's like no difference between my professional behavior style, shall we say, and kind of how I act personally. And that's very intentional. First of all, I don't even know if I could fake it, so I don't bother. I don't even try, which gets me in trouble at times, but, you know, makes life more interesting perhaps, although not necessary for everyone, but I try my best. The second thing, so I think asking about someone's leadership style to some extent is almost asking, like, what's your personal style? Like, what's really right. important to you generally? And then that's kind of what's important to me from a leadership standpoint. So I think generally I would say two things. And, you know, one of the reasons why I enjoyed our conversation so much, because they're like the two things that you got the Jewish person and the half Indian Japanese person, but we're still, you know, siblings from another mother, shall we say. And my two things are really living a life of joy and living a life of meaning. And those two are intrinsically related for me. And the more that I can spend my days creating joy and meaning for myself and for my family and for everyone who I touch and for all those around me and for podcast listeners or readers or listeners of the book, then, you know, that's a good day. And any day that I'm spending, whatever, lying in bed, sometimes you need that to recharge. I don't need it much. Other people do, and that's okay. If they need it, then they should take it. Any day that I spend, you know, in cold, frigid weather, you know, binge watching Netflix, that's not as good a day. Unless, again, I need that, which is okay, in order to do the things that I want to be spending my time doing, which is helping joy and driving meaning. And for me, I think whether it was because of the way I was brought up, or because some friends of mine had passed away when I was at an early age, or whatever reason, just kind of living as meaningful a personal life and a work life as possible is kind of what it's about. So that's really what I try to do for everyone that we can. And fortunately at Meetup, it's really easy because what we provide is so meaningful.
Beautiful, beautiful. You know, you're so busy, you're running your CEO. Why now? Why does this book need to exist? What was your inspiration for this book?
So one thing that's particularly meaningful to me is education and teaching. So for 8 years now, I've been a professor at first Pace University and then Columbia University for the last 7 years, and teaching entrepreneurship and strategic planning to graduate school students. And that's deeply, deeply meaningful. And the reason why I enjoy it so much is because it helps people to become more, figure out what they want to be doing, helps them in their jobs, helps them in their lives, et cetera. But you have 70 students. And that's a big class, but it's 70 people that I'm able to deeply impact. And if you think about a T, you know, and ideally from an influence standpoint and from a helping standpoint, I want to go deep with, you know, super deep with people in my family, for example. That's like the deepest way I want to help and support them. And then be able to help, you know, my 70 students and teach, but also a book, whether it's an audio book or whatever, what it's able to do is it's able to help potentially millions of people. Now, I don't know if the book is going to help millions of people, but it'll help however many people read or listen to the book. So my number one driver was, like I said before, joy and meaning. So a book fits perfectly into that subset of helping to drive meaning for myself and for others. And also in terms of joy, truthfully, writing the book was a joyful exercise. I mean, I know that sounds crazy because it's stressful, but it wasn't for me. I kind of like in 2 months, I kind of just vomited out this, you know, all these crazy experiences that happened at WeWork and built a framework around decision-making. And editors, hopefully, you know, they cleaned it up and HarperCollins was a great publisher. And, you know, the same anchors in life, like I said, joy and meaning, the book fits kind of perfectly into it. And a last thing I'll say related to this specific question is that I've read a lot of books. We've all read lots of, I've read thousands of books probably. And I've probably read hundreds of business books. And the oftentimes books fall into two categories. They're either the like instructive textbooky, you know, five different points that are just said over and over and over again and kind of more boring in nature and it's kind of repeating the same thing. Or they're these kind of stories that are fun, but they don't necessarily teach you. And I really wanted to write a book that was represented this roller coaster story of career, WeWork, running Meetup during the pandemic, but helping to teach people through some crazy stories and storytelling, you know, lessons around decision-making. So that was the goal. And I think when you're able to be a little bit more entertaining, people retain things better as well.
It is an entertaining book and an entertaining journey. You talk about the pandemic and Meetup having sort of record numbers or revenue, you know, you guys made it out of the pandemic with flying colors. What do you think you did in the pandemic that sort of resulted in this experience?
So number one is we took a step back and did a couple of things. The first thing we did is when the pandemic first hit, we said, what is the goal of Meetup? Is the goal of Meetup IRL in real life, getting together in person? Or is the goal of Meetup to help to build connections between people, to build the 30 million connections a year that we drive between people? And the answer is obvious. Of course, it's about the connections, not IRL. So we got all the engineers in the room together. And within a week, we launched an MVP, a minimum viable product, which basically means a product with lots of problems, where we could make it really easy for people to get together remotely through Zoom or through actually 100 other type of video conferencing platforms. And they can stay connected in a time with the pandemic when people needed connections actually more than ever. So we said, our mission is not about IRL, it's about that. And we pivoted and allowed it. And in the last 2 years of the pandemic, there's been over 5 million online events. Tens of millions of people have gone to online events, and online events is still 30%+ and will continue to be a big part of Meetup because it allows people from different global locations to go to one group, and there's a ton of positives to it. So I think the one thing that we did was that. The second thing that we overemphasized, actually there's three things. Second thing we overemphasized is I talked earlier about process and infrastructure. And when a company like Meetup has been around for 20 years, in fact, this June is our 20-year anniversary. You will be invited to the big celebration. Maybe we'll do some Daybreaker dancing right in the beginning of it. Absolutely. That would be totally awesome. So when you're on for 20 years, you accumulate all this what's called technical debt, which is essentially, for non-techies there, just millions of lines of code that accumulate after one project, after another project, after thousands of projects, where you don't necessarily take the time to eliminate code that you built, but you keep just adding on and adding on band-aid after band-aid after band-aid and band-aid. So that to make one little change that could take a week, it takes like 4 months to make a change that could take a week. And that's just not sustainable. So we replatformed most of Meetup to make it much easier for us to make changes, eliminate challenges within the technology. And we looked at this as an opportunity to say, hey, let's build better infrastructure and process during this time, because people are not going to as many in-person events. So it gives us that ability to do so. And we're not going to be growing as much because of that. And the third thing that we did is we said, let's focus on how we can do our job in helping our organizers and our members better. So we hired an amazing head of content, Mary Garcia, and we had Janine Miaton and a whole bunch of other people who work in the organization, who built a blog out called Community Matters that 1.5 million people are getting. We built a podcast, Keep Connected, that 50 to 100,000 people have already been listening to podcast episodes. We created something called Meetup Live, which allows people to learn about best practices around organizing and community. And there are over 100,000 members of that group. It's now went from nothing to the largest group in Meetup. So we did all those things to support our organizers and members. And it's helped us so far.
So it's so epic. So how do you decide on price points for membership, for example? So like, you know, as you're sort of as a leader of a community who wants to obviously create connections, how do you sort of leverage, again, sort of, we want to make all these connections, we also need to keep a business afloat. How did you decide on, I guess it's a membership, right? That's the revenue model for it.
Yep.
What is your decision-making framework for how you decide to price your product or service?
Great. So two of the things I talk about in the book are around decision-making, the importance of being bold and also being speedy. So what that oftentimes means when it comes to decisions is you will roll something out. It may not be great. You're going to learn from it, and then you're going to pivot. The key is that you don't spend too much time trying to figure out what you should do and then roll something out and then also learn it's a problem, but you've spent 6 months trying to roll the thing out in the first place. You can't really know anything until it's in market is the bottom line. So Scott Heiferman, our founder, made a pivotal decision 15 years ago around Meetup pricing. And it was a hard lesson that he learned that I'm going to share with all of you, because it comes down to pricing, and that could help people, Meetup organizers, members, understand our pricing model. So originally, becoming a Meetup organizer was free for all individuals. And the result of that was within a year or two of Meetup's founding, he had thousands of people that were stepping up and becoming organizers. And that was a great way to kind of grow fast. You know, WeWorkian, shall we say, it was just growth, 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 growth. But the problem with that was that so many organizers weren't necessarily doing a quality job in organizing because they didn't have any skin in the game. They weren't necessarily paying anything for it. So we had all these groups that were created that were kind of like empty groups. They were groups, but there were no events happening. So people would join these groups, get excited about joining a group, and then nothing would happen. So he made a very important decision on pricing, to get to your very specific question. He said, we're going to start charging, and he started with $10 a month to become a Meetup organizer. I kid you not, Radha, overnight, the number of organizers declined by 90%. 90% for just $10 is not an insignificant amount of money, but it's not an enormous amount of money either. 90%. And it took 3 years for the company to get back to the same number of organizers. But what was genius about Scott's move is he realized that if the company kept growing with poor experiences for its members and its organizers, then that growth was inevitably going to lead to a crash.
Of course.
And instead, what he said is, we're going to take the pain and actually charge our organizers just to, so that they know that if the, psychologically, when you're paying for something, you're going to put more time into it. It's just the way that our minds tend to work.
Of course. Whenever we do an event, yeah, it ends up being less people show up than a paid ticketed event, a Daybreaker. Wild.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Oftentimes organizers will say to us, hey, how could I get more people to come to my event? And the answer is to show up. The answer is charge $5, charge $2, charge a tiny amount of money. But psychologically, people don't necessarily think about the sunk cost fallacy. They think, I paid the money, now I need to go. And then people go. So hopefully that's helpful in understanding our model, which is organizers pay a relatively nominal amount, but we also equip organizers with tools so that they could charge dues to their members and they could offset that fee. They could have their groups be sponsored and that could offset the fee. There's a whole host of things that we provide organizers to offset those types of fees. And we also have a decent amount of our company's growth has been in businesses that build out communities and support community growth, whether it's Google or IBM or AWS, et cetera.
Well, what this says to me with between Scott and your leadership is just long-term leadership vision. I have so much respect for that. So really, really cool.
The world is oftentimes against leaders having a long-term perspective is the reality. When you're a public company and you're held to hitting quarterly financial projections, it's a great driver for people to end up becoming more short-term focused than they should be. So unfortunately, there's our financial incentives for more short-term thinking. Meetup is not a public company, so we have a lot more flexibility for that reason.
Getting back to, you know, you as a human, you know, what is the difference between being nice and kind? You know, you talk about that in your book, but how does this influence trapdoor decisions?
So I think one of the mistakes that I personally have made when I was early in my leadership journey, and I think a lot of leaders tend to do this, is you want to be liked. And I am the kind of person that does want to be liked. And a good way to be liked is to be nice. And it's not to criticize people or not, first of all, never would you criticize people, not criticize people's actions, not to necessarily upset people. And I learned that there's a big difference, however, between being nice and being kind. Sometimes the kindest thing you could do is to say to someone, this job that you're in right now may not be what you're meant to be doing. You should probably start looking for another opportunity. That's not so nice. You're kind of asking the person to leave the company, but it could be the kindest thing that you do. If you think about like good friends that are truly kind to each other, will tell person where it's at. And we'll say to someone like, what are you doing? Or we'll call people out on their BS. And that's what being kind is. And we should always strive to be kind, not just kind of quote unquote, be more nice, which doesn't necessarily help people to the greatest extent. And when you're making a decision, distinguish between, am I trying to be nice and help someone in this short term right now? Or am I really being kind and helping this person? Am I really being kind and helping the company make the ultimately right decision, you know, for the future?
I love that. On the other side of that, as a leader who understands the difference between nice and kind, when you're selecting and choosing your team members that you hire, obviously having come from an HR background, which I think is actually epic as a CEO, and I think every CEO should go through HR training, by the way. How do you decide as a leader the type, the qualities, sort of the culture fit of team members that you're hiring?
Yeah, so I think it's extremely important for companies to have a set of core values that they truly live by. Not core values that are like on a wall that no one looks at, but core values, and I'll share with you Meetup's core values, but core values that are embedded within all the elements of how of a company's culture, that are embedded into the recruiting process. When you recruit, you look for these core values. When you do performance management, you give people reviews, you review people relative to those values. And we have a 360-degree feedback process, which is getting feedback from where people have the opportunity to learn from their manager, from their peers, from their subordinates, 360 degrees, all questions are relative to these core values that we have. Promotions happen happens relative to core value. So it needs to be embedded into the processes and infrastructure, like I talked earlier, for those values to be ultimately sustainable. We even have rewards regarding some of our core values. So you ask, what the heck are Meetup's core values? Here we go. So the first is trust and transparency. We essentially be as transparent as possible in running an organization because that builds trust. The second is embrace change, not just like accept change, not let change kind of happen to you begrudgingly, but embrace it. Embrace change as an opportunity for yourself and for others. That's number two. Number three is elevate people. Understand that people are how everything happens, and elevating people makes for great organizations. Number four is lead with integrity. Everything that we do needs to have that pass the test of from integrity standpoint. Number five is step up, which is don't just think about your job as, you know, a little microcosm. This is my job. I can't go left. I can't go right. I just got to do my job. No. Your job is to find any opportunities to take your amazing talents and step up and do things that aren't necessary in your job description, but you want to become part of your job description. Step up. And we have a step up award that we give out every month to someone who's nominated for it. And we give a financial thank you to the person who wins that step up award. That's the fifth. And the sixth is focus on impact. In order to have the greatest possible impact, you need to have focus. You can't be doing a million different things and expect someone to succeed. Focus drives impact. Those are the six. And we embed those, you know, throughout the company. And those values end up highly influencing the decision processes that we make.
Wow, I really, really connect with all of them. They're so thoughtful. You know, at Daybreaker, before we even launched our first event, we also wrote down five core values that continue to be our North Star for all of our decisions. Ours are wellness. So it's all about sort of being well and healthy, wellness, holistic health and wellness. Camaraderie, which is about sort of, you know, one-to-one and one-to-many. So community can often feel sort of pretty large and often vague. The camaraderie felt a little bit more one-to-one connected. Self-expression, which is all about allowing your body to move and finding the courage to express yourself. Mindfulness, which is about presence and being here now. And mischief, which is, again, living life with a wink and not taking life so seriously. So those five core values, just like you, are the lens that we look at, you know, all of our partners, our talent, our just, you know, every aspect of the value chain as well. But yours really resonate also for internal culture. Ours, I think we wrote more for external culture. This feels like core values for internal culture, which I actually want to implement as well. These exact ones, I think, in mind. It's awesome. It's awesome. So jumping back in, so you talk about, there's so much about the book that I feel like, of course, resonates. I think writing a book is so interesting because you get to sort of really reflect on all the things that you've worked on and then begin distilling them down into frameworks, into repeatable, retweetable, bite-sized things that people can then take with them. So can you just share a little bit more about how you organize your, you know, so it starts with week zero, your first 3 days, your next 60 days, your next 90 days. And I just loved sort of the way you broke down each of these very important sort of formative parts of your leadership experience. And so can you just sort of give us a bit more color about the difference, you know, in each of these, like day zero, so days 30, day 60, and why you break it down in that way?
Sure. I think starting with day zero is I think most leaders don't understand that day one, you're already under a complete and total microscope. And everyone looks at every little move that you do. And you're going to be overwhelmed as soon as you start an organization. So your success in your first 30 days, 60 days, year is going to be actually incredibly dependent and influenced by the work that you do prior to starting. Do not accept a job on a Friday and then start on Monday and expect that you're going to hit it out of the park. You could end up struggling in any role. Try to get information, as much information as you can about the company, about your role, about what you're doing prior to starting. And that allows you to then hit it more out of the park and do a better job, by the way, in listening and asking the right questions, which is the best thing that a leader can do on day one by doing the homework beforehand. So what I did and what I encourage all leaders to do in terms of quote unquote day zero is when I accepted, my first official day was a week prior to even being announced and meeting all employees. I spent the entire week with numerous people on the executive team, with people at WeWork, with the founder, Scott. I went to a whole bunch of meetup events also and talked to meetup organizers and meetup members. And I asked a whole lot of questions and I ascertained that there were 6, 7, 8 themes that were going on at meetup that we need to spend time right when we started in learning more about. And if I didn't take 40 to 60 to 80 hours before starting to do all that homework, it would have been a lot more difficult in day one. And then in day one, what happened is we identified these 6 to 8 themes. So an example of one theme was, we're doing too many different things. What should we stop doing? That was a theme that I had heard. So then what we did is we created a work stream with people volunteering to join one of these big questions and these big themes. And they met every single day for 2 weeks. We had to prioritize over other work that they were doing. And then they told me, the CEO, what we should ultimately do, what we should stop doing. And then 2 weeks later, we had the organization kind of galvanized in making suggested changes. And I just said, yeah, that makes sense. Yep, that makes sense. Yep, that makes sense. And it was a lot easier to then make change happen very, very quickly because it came from the people. But ultimately, had I not done all that preparation kind of beforehand and all those meetings beforehand, we wouldn't have known the right questions to ask. And one of the most important things that I think a leader can do is simply ask the right question. Spending your time and figuring out the right question to be asking will end up driving what you're answering, and what you're answering will end up driving what actually actions you take and you prioritize. So that's a little bit about, you know, the day zero in the book.
But again, like that shows such a dedication. I think that speaks volumes of you as a human being and you as a leader as well. How do you know what the right questions are to ask?
I think the answer is you don't, but you know, being thoughtful about what questions you're asking are very, very important. If you put so much pressure on yourself that the question you're asking is the perfect question, quote unquote, to be asking, it's not going to necessarily be healthy. So I think one step is first saying, I may not ask all the perfect questions, but I'm going to be really thoughtful about each question and determine whether or not it's the right question. However, the right questions are ones oftentimes are more controversial in nature. If it's a softball, if it's a question like, how do we grow faster? Like, come on, everyone's thought about that question before. If it's, however, what do we need to deprioritize and stop doing because we've been doing it forever and it isn't working? Whoa, that's a more controversial question. That unfortunately could make some people feel a little bit less comfortable. That may not be a nice question to ask because people might not like to hear the answers because people are working on some of those things that may need to be deprioritized. But that is the reason why it's so important to ask it, because people oftentimes run away from things that could be more controversial in nature in order that everyone be kind of as happy and content as possible, which oftentimes results in everyone doing a million different things, none of which is actually the right focus. So I would say if your questions are not going to create any type of disagreement, then it's not the right question, like we talked about earlier. If your question is potentially not going to cause some actions to be taken that make you feel uncomfortable, then it may not be the right question. And if people can get away with broad and general answers to the question, then it's also not the right question, because great questions are ones that have that require a specificity of answer that doesn't let people just kind of get away with a broad statement, because a specificity of answer will drive a specific action. And what you want is actions, not kind of broad statements.
Yeah, and it also sounds like what you're saying is, you know, you're not precious with, I mean, you are precious with the questions you ask, but you also recognize that at the very beginning, day zero, it's okay to be messy in terms of not having the exact right question. It's okay. You're not going to beat yourself up for not being perfect. And that asking, sort of honing or iterating on your questions from a lens of courage and confidence and just wanting to go in and be curious about how to make things better. I think that's also an important place to start, because I think, again, the pressure that you put on yourself as a first-time leader or even as a seasoned leader to ask the right questions can be very, very stressful. And so to remember that it's all a playful experience, that you talk about joy and meaning, you know, I can only see you just jumping into these meetup groups, asking questions and curiously bounding around and, you know, calling up different executives and just being so enthusiastic and which again breeds excitement on the other side. So, I think that
I love what you said. I messiness is important in the beginning, being comfortable with being uncomfortable. Comfortable, like I talk about healthy tension a lot, being comfortable with tension. Tension is healthy. When you don't have tension, it means that everyone's in agreement. What the heck does that do? Being comfortable with things being a little bit messy, because through the messiness, knowing that you're going to get order, but being through the messiness, you'll give space to give people the ability to think more broadly, and then you could create order. But oftentimes people start with too much order in the beginning, and then it is debilitating, and it keeps broad thinking from actually happening. And, you know, sometimes you need much broader creative solutions and you need a little messiness to get there, a little mischief.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also the other takeaway that I got from just this series of questions is the idea that you're sort of inviting participation from the team who've been there from the very beginning, and that you're inviting them to give you the answers. And so that sort of hand reaching out, sort of tell me what you know versus I know what to do, I'm going to tell you what to do, which so many leaders do to their teams. I really also think that that's the recipe for a successful both business and community internally. So that those are the two, the messiness and the participatory invitation from your team members, which I think is beautiful.
Yeah. You know, I remember day one, my first day, I got announced to 250 people to meet up. I had the president of WeWork standing right next to me, introducing me. You know, I'm so sweaty and nervous and everything else. Played my pump up song beforehand, you know, got myself ready. And someone raised their hand and they said, David, what's the company strategy? What's the strategy going to be? And I'm like, I have absolutely no idea what the strategy is, but what I do know is that there are some values that are really important to me. So I'm going to share with you some values that are important to me, and we're going to figure out the strategy together, and you're going to be a big part of figuring that out, but I ain't going to tell you anything about that.
Oh, God. Was everyone just like smiling and excited and grateful? I'm sure.
That sounds nice. I'm not sure though, but...
No, that's exactly the way a leader should step onto a stage when they first come in. I really respect, just respect your communitas, your focus on the community listening.
I mean, I think though, to answer your question, I think people to varying degrees feel comfortable with ambiguity. Many people don't like ambiguity for lots of good reasons. There's people have greater levels oftentimes of anxiety in more ambiguous situations. Sometimes people want to hear, this is it, this is the answer, and it helps them. So I don't think actually people did feel, many people, some people did, some people kind of gratitude or excitement. There's more nervousness about change. And by the way, that's the most normal thing in the world, for people to be nervous about change and for it to be a source of concern. And it's important to acknowledge it, but it's important not to then, you know, again, listen, but selectively follow, but not to necessarily make it more comfortable for people to say, here's the answer, but to say, we're going to be in a period of ambiguity for time. And I know that that's hard for you, and to acknowledge it and to be as empathetic as possible and try to put a plan together of how the ambiguity is going to end. But I would say in the beginning, there was probably more nervousness than anything else, honestly.
Well, I think again that messiness is part of the journey, right? So for everyone, for both employees and leaders to know on both sides what to expect, I think that's also comforting. So in the rest of your book, you talk about the next 60 days, the next 90 days, all the things, you know, leading to new territory, facing the unknown unknowns. There's so much juice and good stuff in this book, David, really. And I'm not just blowing smoke. If the readers, you know, want to take away one thing from your book, or what do you hope readers will take away from this?
Okay. Thank you for asking that, actually. Here's my one takeaway, which is that I think all too often people, when you think about, some people have more of an external locus of control and they believe that things happen to them. Other people have more of an internal locus of control and they believe that things in their life they could control. And sometimes it's too great to a degree. And the reality is there's internal and there's external, the things that you can control, things that you can't control. However, when it comes to work, too often people will think, I can't influence that. I can't change that. This is above my pay grade. This is outside my sphere of influence. And I think the one thing that I want people to take away from the book is that every single person, whether you're right out of college, when you're in college, whether you're a manager level, senior level, CEO, whatever it is, you have a lot more influence on your future than you realize. You can make decisions within your company, outside of your company, in your personal life, in your professional life, that can change the course of your life. They can make things better. If you're stuck, you could get unstuck. And the biggest takeaway for me is, for someone from the book, is to say, I can make decisions. Here's a framework for making decisions. I can get out of bad situations personally or professionally. And I can influence things, even if I don't have the ultimate authority to make that final decision. To me, that's the biggest win. And if people do that, hopefully they live happier, more meaningful, more joyful lives. And that's the goal of the book.
I love it. And do you think, you know, as a final, you know, couple questions here before we're at time, you know, do you think that this leadership framework can be applied in your home life, with your own family, with your friends, in your romantic relationships? How can you take some of the principles that you talk about in the book and apply it when things are so much more tender, where kids might not necessarily listen to you as a leader of your household? How do you manage those challenges, both as a parent and a leader?
Wait, my three teenage kids are 20, 17, 14 to listen to everything I say, huh? So they definitely don't, by the way. So I'll take one principle and I'll apply it to personal life. And the answer is, I think everything could apply to personal life, which is, be surprised only about being surprised. And what that means really is, the job of people generally, both personally and professionally, is to avoid surprising others. How many times are people in a relationship and they think everything's going amazingly well, and then suddenly they break up and it's like, what? Where'd that come from? Well, there's a failure there, right? How do you avoid surprising people that you love? How do you avoid surprising people that you care about? How do you avoid surprising people at work? How do I, as a leader, avoid surprising my board of directors, our investors? How do I avoid surprising people who work for me? How do I avoid surprising other people? The answer is to be comfortable talking about uncomfortable topics, to be comfortable talking about things that are kind that may not be nice, to be comfortable that, and to understand that any time that you've surprised someone, you failed and you've made a mistake. So I think that's incredibly relevant for people's personal lives, because so often people end up making a decision in one's personal life and be surprised that had they had that conversation prior to it, had they talked about what was frustrating them when it was a 1 out of 10 in frustration or a 3 out of 10 in frustration, and then it waited until it became a 10 out of 10 in frustration, right? Then a lot of good could have happened from that. So that's, to me, a principle around not to surprise others that applies to personal and professional. I think a lot of them do, but that one particularly resonates for me.
You're the best. I love you. Okay, last question. You know, because I think this is something that is so near and dear to both of our hearts. You know, and I think sort of like leave the listeners with this sort of counsel in mind, you know, why is loneliness so dangerous right now? And what can listeners continue to be reminding themselves every day over and over again to not be in states of loneliness? Like, why is it dangerous? And what can anyone do? Both of us probably being in the world of belonging and community, I think this is a question I always get, but curious to hear your answer to that.
Sure. I think it's more dangerous today than it was a generation ago. And my generation, quote unquote, before my parents' generation, really because of the double-edged sword of technology. Technology is an enabler towards amazing things like Daybreaker and like Meetup, but it's also a disenabler towards in-person connecting, towards community, towards going out and doing things. And my biggest fear around loneliness is the ability to be able to be fully entertained and to be fully busy, quote unquote, while feeling completely lonely at the same time. In the past, without technology, the only way to not feel lonely temporarily was to go out and try to do things and be with other people. Today, you could spend 10 straight hours playing video games or on your phone looking at social media and be busy or watching TV, but you could also be the loneliest person out there. And to me, that's one of the biggest dangers today. And what Meetup, what we say is we use technology to get people off of technology. We use good to try to do more good. And that's why it's such a risk. And I fear for the meta world and the metaverse when we may or may not need to be in front of people directly all the time to be able to really build that community. And in reality, that's where all great things happen. That's where love happens. That's where personal growth happens in person. So it's very scary. I think the number of people that, especially after the pandemic, during the pandemic, that depression is unfortunately at an all-time level high in every country around the world. Suicides are at all-time highs in the US and also in other places, Japan in particular, and around the world. And all that is a result of loneliness. And our goal is to help people live joyful, meaningful lives. And loneliness is kind of, the opposite of being able to do so.
What a way to sort of, I guess, end cap this beautiful conversation. I think it's for all of us to be reminded that, right, belonging is the root of all possibility and abundance. Belonging, community, investing in Meetup communities, investing in loving leadership, thoughtful leadership, truly is such a gateway out of loneliness. And, again, the best leaders in the world as well think of not just their employees as sort of tools to grow their business, but through the lens of how can they make their lives better? How can they make them feel a sense of belonging inside and outside the office? And you're a clear example of that. So David Siegel, I'm so excited to be on the other side of Mike today with you. What an honor it is to have just over an hour together to unpack your leadership and your amazing new book, Decide and Conquer, which comes out soon here. And I can't wait to share it with my team and continue spreading the gospel of Meetup. So, and also, I look forward to seeing you on the dance floor as well very soon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me on my podcast. I appreciate it.
So thanks for listening, everyone. Wow, we covered a lot of ground today. We learned about the importance of long-term leadership, that leadership can be messy at times, that it's important to surround ourselves with humans who don't agree with us all the time, and that being nice is different from being kind. Thanks for listening again. Please subscribe and get your copy of Decide and Conquer on Amazon or your local bookstore. Let's keep connected because life is better together.
One of the best ways to make new friends and build a strong community is to find people who share your interests. Whether you want to make new hiking buddies, join a book club, or network and grow a business, there are countless people on Meetup who are ready to connect. Start your own group on Meetup and save 30% on your first subscription payment. Go to meetupsavings.com to claim your discount.